The stories we just heard about predicted increases in heat and flooding in our region, along with news about extreme weather elsewhere, like drought and wildfires, can be a lot to take in. Add to that headlines about increasingly dire international climate reports and warnings from climate scientists that we have just a decade to make the changes to stop the most catastrophic climate impacts. It's no wonder that many of us are experiencing some pretty strong emotions around these issues, even what some have called eco-anxiety. More people are looking at these feelings to help people cope, like Britt Ray. She's a broadcaster, author, and researcher, and her latest book is Generation Dread: Finding Purpose in an Age of Climate Crisis. And I got a chance to talk with Ray about it recently. What's your definition of eco-anxiety?
I think of eco-anxiety as this storm of emotions. It's not only a singular type of anxiety related to ecological degradation. It also includes feelings of sadness or grief or anger and general distress about what's going on with the climate and wider ecological crisis. And these emotions can be constructive. They can be adaptive. They can point important things out to you about what's under threat and cause you to make change in your life and band together with others, take action. But they can also, because of their deep existential nature, when they make people feel truly unsafe in the world and fear the future in a very chronic way, it can become disruptive to daily functioning, overwhelming, and therefore a huge impediment to mental health and well-being.
How does eco or climate anxiety show up in people's thinking and behavior?
In really diverse ways. So it doesn't show up at one severity level. There's a scale that a climate aware therapist, Caroline Hickman, has come up with that really charts this based on observations with thousands of people around the world who she's helped as a therapist with this. And so let's say at the mild level, if someone's starting to get a whiff of eco-anxiety, they might feel uncomfortable in a grocery aisle surrounded by single-use plastic-wrapped vegetables, let's say, and it becomes uncomfortable for them and they become kind of paralyzed with how to navigate that shopping experience. But something that could be a bit more significant for someone would be, okay, I've had a significant wake up to the severity of the climate predicament. Maybe I don't feel comfortable having children anymore, and my partner wants to, and we're in a huge conflict over that. Maybe we're going to split up. You know, these kinds of relationship issues can become quite pronounced. If the feelings are really severe, a person might not be able to sleep anymore, not be able to concentrate, go to work, go to school, and unfortunately, maybe even become suicidal and self-harming. So it really runs the gamut of all forms of manifestation of the distress.
I was interested in this idea of an internal facing of our fears and emotions around environmental crisis, and then that outward facing of the problem by taking some action in the world to try to change things. Can you say a little bit more about the relationship between the two?
Yes. So we are very used to a sense of urgency on the climate crisis. We've had that truth imprinted into us over decades of environmental and political campaigning on the issue. And it's true. We do need external action in terms of our policies, our technologies, our innovations, our science in a dramatic way, right? So we need to be bold. At the same time, we have not often recognized that in order to shore ourselves up psychologically, mentally, emotionally, to be able to do that work, which is hard and strenuous over the long term, essentially for the rest of our lives, because this crisis will be confronting with us over that time period and getting harder. Well, we can't do that from a depleted internal state. It is very much a neighborhood of burnout that many activists and green politicians and climate scientists and other people who are working on this problem full time experience because of the mental exhaustion of knowing that we have solutions, continuously seeing their importance disavowed and denied and not deployed by leaders who could otherwise do so. That is just a process that taps people out, and it leaves them essentially deflated and sometimes despairing, which becomes easier as an individual to turn away. It's just too painful. But that can be resolved if work and attention is paid to the internal emotional resilience building practices that are also available to us to fill our cup up enough to be able to be convicted, resilient, connected, and grounded in a really deep way so that even as the going gets tough and tougher, we can stay in the work. It's just that we haven't often recognized that there are internal skills and strategies that are just as important to environmental struggle as there are these external actions. But of course, many social justice activists have known this around legacies of colonization, slavery, systemic racism. I mean, we can look to many different movements where predominantly people of color have been working to improve their situation and understanding you need to be able to restore yourself internally to be able to take on the oppressions outside of you. And while climate scientists have not been trained to think about that, it's relevant here as well. And those are the kinds of arguments that the book makes in terms of turning inward to do whatever you need to do to integrate in a helpful way the anxiety and anger and grief that comes with confronting this crisis and bearing witness to more loss, and then being able to be externally strengthened and in relationship with others to push on the levers that we have to prevent more harm and save what we can.
Yeah, I wanted to ask where privilege comes into this. Is eco-anxiety the manifestation of, you know, white middle-class fears, while many people are already facing other existential threats like systemic racism or other systems of oppression?
Yeah, so the data tells us that no, it actually is more pronounced for communities of color and often poor communities of color. So one study that my colleagues and I did, we looked at 10,000 16 to 25-year-olds in 10 countries around the world. We were trying to understand the scope and burden of their climate anxiety. Places like India, Philippines, Nigeria, but also the US, UK, France, and some other countries. And we found that, you know, 45% of these young people around the world said that their feelings about the climate crisis are negatively impacting their daily functioning. So eating, sleeping, working, concentrating, playing, having fun, those types of things. But in Nigeria, India, and Philippines, for example, it was much more pronounced than the global average. It was more around 67%, which is, again, showing us these low and middle income countries that have greater exposure to climate hazards already are being more disturbed from their distress in terms of just how they can get through normal tasks. And also in the US, we have data from the Yale program on climate communication that shows us that Black and Latino communities are more likely to be alarmed about the climate crisis than their white counterparts, and subjectively also more willing to move into a position of power and agency and take some action on the topic because of their disproportionate exposure to the harms. So really, it's just an extra load of burden on top of marginalized communities, and why we tend to have this reaction that we think maybe it's just a privileged preoccupation. It's just that it's the first time that some privileged people are feeling destabilized in the world in terms of their own safety. And so it's the best way to describe their distress, but it's not the best way to describe other communities' distress where, you know, there might be more immediate threats.
Maybe not surprisingly, you write that climate anxiety affects kids the most. What can parents or teachers or the adults in their lives do to help them to cope?
So it definitely does affect younger folks in a hugely outsized way. And one thing that makes this so hard is, well, going back to that study I mentioned of the 10,000 16, 25-year-olds that we did, we found not only, you know, was there disrupted daily functioning? 75% said the future is frightening. 39% said that the climate crisis makes them hesitant to have their own kids. 56% said humanity is doomed. Importantly, all of these sentiments were tightly correlated with the sense of being betrayed by governments and lied to by leaders, which introduces this important concept of institutional betrayal and the psychological harm that can come when people with less power require responses from people with more power in order to be protected and have their well-being upheld. But when those with more power aren't really leaning into that responsibility and doing right by it, this then creates all kinds of negative emotional, mental health impacts on those who are dependent on them, right? It makes sense. And this is the widespread intergenerational problem that we're dealing with on the climate crisis. Young people feel abandoned, belittled, dismissed in their distress by older generations who aren't stepping up to help them in this time and instead are often saying things like, well, you know, when it gets really bad, I won't be around. So, you know, these kinds of maybe trying to use some gallows humor, but actually ends up making the distress much more severe for young people because it's a direct abandonment on something that is overwhelming that they unfairly inherited along with the duty to clean it up. And they're made aware of this before they can even vote and have any agency to enact to change the structures that are stressing them. You know, it's just injustice all the way down, which means a site of serious repair would be stepping into solidarity, would be showing young people that you get it if we're older, that we're there for them, that we are not going to simply sit around on our couches and hope for a better future, or rather offload our hope into young people who will save the day, but actually take up our, you know, link arms with them, roll up our sleeves and use this amazing opportunity we have with this wild time in which we're living to step into some purpose and support them. You know, if that institutional betrayal piece could be minimized by watching people within and outside of institutions come together on this issue, even as the world is burning, young people would be feeling much better. They would be less isolated, less alienated, and would know that, you know, people cared.
What keeps people from acknowledging and working through their emotions about the climate crisis? I'm wondering if the stigma that still exists around mental illness plays into it, you know, using the word anxiety.
Yeah, unfortunately, mental illness and mental health, even just the term mental health, has stigma around it. And it's beyond time that we move on from that place, but it isn't yet a uniform reality, even though many strides and progress have been made towards normalizing mental health as a public priority. And so, yeah, climate anxiety, eco-anxiety can sound to the average ear as though it means clinical anxiety disorder. It's some kind of pathology, something that you could maybe get a diagnosis for. However, that's not the case. These terms are not in the DSM. They are not conditions that a mental health professional can deem you to have in any kind of clinical way. And so many mental health professionals argue that these terms ought to stay out of the DSM because they're really not a sign of ill health. It's not a sickness. Rather, they're a healthy, normal, natural response to what's going on because we are facing a real civilizational and existential threat when it comes to the degradation of our life support systems in an escalating climate and ecological crisis. We have evolved to have anxiety for very productive means, right? It points out that something that we care deeply about, something that we rely on, is in danger or under threat, and it, you know, gets our attention on it so that we can mobilize some resources and muster the resilience to do what we can to alleviate the threat and help ourselves and others along the way. That's what's happening right now. We're feeling the trauma to the earth and vulnerable communities and species. And in this way, it's productive. It's just that it can become too intense for people. And so that is when it can tip over into needing real mental health care support and maybe become something that is more aligned with debilitating anxiety. But for the most part, it's just a sign that you're humane and that you care and that you're compassionate and that you're awake to what's going on. Anyone's really able to tap into this if they understand that their health is reliant upon the health of the environment.
How can people, what kind of strategies can people use to fill their cup so that they can take some action or feel like they can make some change?
There's so much in terms of the personal approaches for working around anxiety and grief and overwhelm and despair that are available to us, including, you know, making space for yourself to rest, making space for yourself to cultivate joy, not feeling ashamed if you take on times in a regular way in your schedule to do that. It's not a luxury, it's actually a necessity. There's mindfulness and meditation. There are groups to talk about these concerns. Eco-anxiety is becoming so overwhelming for many people that There's now a cottage industry of support. There's climate aware therapy. There's a burgeoning space now of mental health professionals who explicitly start from the standpoint of saying, we will never minimize or dismiss or pathologize these feelings. We understand them to be normal and healthy, and our job is to help you fold them into your lives so that you can cope better and move forward and not get stuck in any one dire place with it. That's just the tip of the iceberg, but it's important to know that there are really no one way to deal with this, and whatever works for you and feels authentic is what you should be exploring.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me about this.
Well, thank you for wanting to.
Britt Ray is the author of the new book, Generation Dread: Finding Purpose in an Age of Climate Crisis. She also publishes the weekly newsletter, Gen Dread. Ray is currently a human and planetary health fellow at Stanford University and the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. There's more of our reporting about climate anxiety in our series, Pollution's Mental Toll, at alleghenyfront.org/mentalhealth. You're listening to The Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple.